Hello, this is Kevin Holtzbier again, and welcome to part two of Collected Miscellanies conversation with Joseph Bottom on his new book, An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America. So let's return to our discussion with Joseph Bottom.
Where do we find ourselves today? The one thing you seem to indicate that you don't feel like the evangelicals that have left the mainline churches but remained religious are really a coherent enough force to take the place. The Catholics are not prepared for it. What do you see as the institution that might play that role going forward?
Well, I think it's the poster children and their moral vocabulary for at least the next little bit. I mean, they have a repopulated metaphysical realm. They have a rich, fairly rich, spiritual life, and they're in charge for the next visible period, the next few years. They're very much going to be in charge, as we witness by, you know, their manifestations, their successful manifestations of high moral claims in the public square. Much of it is gestural, you know, but gestures like that reveal spirituality. You know, what else is, you know, the 1 gallon toilet flush that Congress required, except a gesture, and a gesture to what? To a high moral position and an almost metaphysical understanding of the world as populated by these dark sins of the past for which we must atone. And those people and their church are going to be in charge for the next visible period. I think the conservative and religious writers who complain, as they have since, you know, the 1890s, about how strange it is to live in this scientized, atheistical world that has no metaphysical richness in it, no ontological density, and how can anyone live like that? I think that complaint on the conservative side is completely mistaken and blinds us to what's actually going on. For the poster children, this post-Protestant class, actually live with a rich, thick metaphysical world. I say in the book, they're like people who reject the idea of ghosts as superstitious nonsense, even while they believe that all around them live ectoplasmic projections of the dead. They reject this old religious notion, and yet they are as superstitious, as spiritual, and as mystical as any group has ever been in America.
Well, it's interesting to me that you seem to be, in your other writing, and sometimes sort of between the lines here, arguing for a different approach, sort of rather than a combative, antagonistic fighting, or almost a nostalgic wish for an old world to return, an acknowledgement of the world as it exists today. And it doesn't seem explicit in the book, but a call to try to communicate in light of that reality. Do you think that's what conservatives and others should try to engage this class, this poster child class? Is there a way to engage that group in culture and pull it in a different direction?
Yeah, several of us are trying different things. You know, new publishing endeavors, new vocabularies and so on, but none looks poised right at the moment to offer any alternative on the cultural level. Nonetheless, I do think you put your finger on something vital here, which is I don't think that we get anywhere not being hard-headed and clear-eyed about what's actually going on. You know, we're not going to resurrect the old American consensus of the mainline Protestant churches. It's gone. And, you know, it's sad. I say in the book that I regret the loss of those churches. I think, you know, something vital went out of America when they disappeared. But disappeared they have. Gone they are. That river, that undivided current has run dry. And with it gone, we have to reassess what it is that we're doing. I think the most quoted line in the book comes actually in the Catholic half. I take up two case studies in the book, the elite class of the poster children and what I call the swallows of Capistrano, who are these highly intellectualized converts and young Catholics during the John Paul II's papacy. And, you know, as we sort of work out these details, it seems to me, and I say in the book, that rebellion against rebellion doesn't escape the problems of rebellion. And a chosen tradition is never quite the same as an inherited one. And that line has gotten ticked up by a number of reviewers. And, you know, attacked to some degree, defended in some degrees, queried in many ways. But I do think that we have to understand that you can't solve the problems of the rejection of old culture by rejecting the rejectors. Rebellion against the rebellions of the 1960s and 70s is itself still a rebellion and partakes of this problem. And the old inherited tradition that, you know, a 1950s Catholic could rely on no longer exists. If you're going to be a Catholic today, a Catholic public intellectual or figure or writer, you have to choose it. You no longer inherit it as simply your cultural and ethnic identity. And that should make a difference. And lo and behold, it does make a difference. I speak about the way the writers of the Catholic Renaissance, from Flannery O'Connor to William F. Buckley, could simply assume their Catholicism and look out on the world and comment on it. Even a generation later, with like Gary Wills and Michael Novak, suddenly the assumption wasn't there. They had to talk constantly about their foundation in Catholicism. And that's a change and a problem for us. I think what's actually going to happen is what's happened before in this country, which is these smaller subcultures, particularly the people who are homeschooling now, will produce dynamic kids who will come out of that training with a firm foundation that they can look out at the world on, and they'll start to make a difference. But until then, these swallows of Capistrano are being driven out of the public square, and they're going to have to form a subculture.
Well, the other thing, sort of jumping off of that, it seems like there's a great deal of tension nowadays. You know, you have the Catholics you're speaking of. I know a great many conservatives who come out of that mold. You have the evangelicals who don't seem to have a sort of thick cultural history to pull from. How, after all, this is a literary website, and you have a literary background, and you've spoken and written about re-enchantment and other ways of approaching things. How do we get out of a sort of combative cultural war mode? How do we begin to try to rebuild a tradition? How do you start along that path of regrowing something or starting afresh when it seems like we're just locked in intellectual combat?
Yeah, and that worries me because I don't see a path out for that. Now, you know, one reviewer recently said, because I don't end the book with a description of the way out, I have failed to hold the virtue of Christian hope, which proves that I have failed to have a sufficient Christian faith. And, you know, this reviewer, a young Protestant reviewer, has just accused me of not being Christian, of having not a strong enough Christian faith to have hope in American culture. And the reason for the accusation is that I don't end the book on an upbeat note about what we do next. That strikes me as an extraordinary thing. Maybe if he didn't like the book, that's fine. But that idea that somehow, you know, the culture wars are the only thing we have is an extraordinary one. And I want to find some way out of it. Now, my next book, the book my agent's shopping right now, is an answer to some degree to the diagnosis that I perform in An Anxious Age, or at least some attempt to put an answer in a way that my poetry books or my short stories haven't been able to convince people of yet. A theoretical idea about how we might re-enchant the world. But, you know, in the meantime, I don't think we understand why that might be an answer, or even if it's not the right answer, why we need some kind of answer. I don't think we reach that point until we absorb the kind of lesson I'm trying to teach in An Anxious Age, and I think others are trying to teach, which is a clear-eyed understanding of where we actually are now.
Well, finally, as we wrap up, I want to talk to you a little bit about the wider literary world, the publishing world, the political world, because you sort of dabbled in so many areas. The one thing stylistically that I found interesting was it seemed like the book was, I don't want to use the word anecdotal, it almost seemed like it was literary in the sense it wanted to discuss history and biography, but not in a sort of academic scientific way, but more in a way of sort of describing, almost sketching out the world and how we came to where we are today. And I thought it just struck me as an interesting sort of style of almost like circling the problems and looking at the key figures and trying to almost sort of map your way out via description rather than as, logical propositions. Did you intentionally try to have a certain style for the reader? Do you have a certain sort of reader in mind? What did you think about as you were trying to make this argument and how you were going to structure the book?
I'm not sure that I had a deliberate plan in mind from the beginning. But as I would make points, I would think this would somehow be stronger if I could give you an example, if I could sketch a picture of someone and ask you, don't you recognize this person and others that you meet? This week brought a review of the book in National Review from Mary Eberstadt that is as praising as anybody's ever written about me. I sort of blush to look at it. But she says in this, what readers probably don't get about Bottom's writing is the extent to which he's a storyteller instead of a sociologist. And he wants to draw a sociological conclusion, she says, but he wants to do so by tossing up a picture and saying, don't you recognize that picture? It has to be kind of self-attesting. Now, she says that the pictures succeed, and maybe they do and maybe they don't. But it is true that the book and the kind of writing I've been doing for the last couple of years is increasingly not involved with straightforward socio-political arguments, or theological political arguments for that matter, but much more attempts to draw pictures. It's a failure on my part to some degree because, you know, it reduces me to being a cartoon thinker. You know, I think in little cartoons and pop them up and say, do you get it? But on the other hand, as I was working out in the book and realizing how many stories I was telling about William F. Buckley, about Bishop Fulton J. Sheen, about Avery Dulles, about kind of composite figures in the post-Protestant classes, I realized that I wanted to do it because I wanted to use them as a way of constructing argument that wasn't partaking of the culture wars vocabulary. I was looking for some other way. Now, as I say, I may have failed at it, but the idea that we need to find some other way to express these ideas, I think, is an accurate one.
Well, what I find interesting is that, and there was a view, I think, one you were referencing earlier, that seemed to very sort of harshly push back against, as if a storytelling process is somehow illegitimate, that you must provide detailed footnotes, you must, you know, make an argument in clear propositional format, or it's invalid, or it's interesting but doesn't mean anything. Have you gotten a lot of pushback in other forums that this sort of storytelling narrative approach outside of the combative intellectualism of the culture war, that it's somehow not a valid, that it's a surrender of some sorts?
Not that it's a surrender. There's one review in particular that was very upset with it, with that technique. A couple other reviews sort of said that they found the technique off-putting. But once they surrendered to it, they could see what I was doing. Nobody has sort of said it's illegitimate on its face. Well, no, actually, one person has said it's illegitimate on its face. But I think it's not what people are expecting. And that may be its virtue or that may be its vice. But, you know, we provoke where we can on the left and the right and try to put new hooks in the water and see what fish we can pull out.
Let's talk a little bit finally about your fiction writing, and I'd be interested just to get your perspective about, you've done Kindle shorts, you've done a variety of fiction output. What has that experience been like? I'm interested sort of in your journey from, you know, a writer in the East Coast in the power centers and at the heart of many of those political, social, religious conversations, and now, you know, writing fiction two time zones away and doing it, you know, e-books and digital readers. It seems like that's a big change from editor of a influential magazine to writing e-books in South Dakota.
Right. I mean, it is deliberate. The fiction is new. I've always done poetry, you know, I'm a very minor poet, but I've been in the, you know, new formalist fights for a long time now. But the fiction is new, and it started actually with a British magazine called Standpoint that, you know, told the editor in an email exchange that I just had an idea for a short story, and he said, well, send it to me when you get it done. And, it, you know, I think it was the short story about the guy who walks into a psychiatrist's office and asks to be hypnotized to believe in God. And I thought, this is a sort of weird idea for putting interesting theological and psychological questions about faith. You know, what's illegitimate about, if you can be hypnotized to quit smoking, what's illegitimate about being hypnotized to believe in God? And there's a nice reversal in the story in which the psychiatrist becomes the guy arguing against hypnosis, and the would-be patient becomes the guy who's putting the pure psychological, modern psychiatric argument that we can be hypnotized into these things. And it was a lot of fun to write. And shortly thereafter, I had a bestseller of a memoir about my childhood around Christmas time, kind of set of snapshots from different Christmases in my childhood. And I thought that kind of storytelling, this is what I want to do now. And it manifests itself in this new sociological study, An Anxious Age, as you've noted. And it's manifesting itself in my essays, even my political essays nowadays. Is, you know, I keep drawing pictures. And no one else, you know, really likes it, but it's satisfying me, so I'm having fun.
What has been your reaction? Have you sort of reached a new audience with the Kindle sales? You know, they had the Christmas story that seemed to do very well. You've had some fictions on the same platform. What has that been like? Is there a difference between, you know, your magazine and political audience and those who found you via your fiction?
Yeah, although that the new audience found me via my nonfiction with my memoir, which was called Dakota Christmas and then was picked up and expanded into a book from Random House called The Christmas Plains. That new audience found me through the nonfiction memoir and has followed me into the fiction I've been doing for the Kindle singles every Christmas, and which are the three Christmas stories. The new one, next year's and the last 2 years are going to be printed as a print book this fall by St. Augustine's Press. But the audience has followed me there. But it is a new, that is the new audience. And I noticed, I don't know, that audience almost never comments on my political writing for the Weekly Standard and elsewhere. Just as the political audience, the people who react to me politically, almost never comment on my poetry or my fiction. As I don't think they're each reading the same thing. You know, they might make a gesture toward my, people who comment on my political writing or my social writing might make a gesture toward saying, you know, Bottom's a published poet or Bottom's a published fiction writer, but they never quote from it, they never analyze it, they never think it has an impact. In the same way, the comments I get on my fiction and my poetry almost never responds to or reacts to my political writing. I'm unsure what that means, and I'm waiting to see whether the audiences will combine to read this new book from Random House, An Anxious Age. And we'll have to see.
Lastly, I'm just curious, was the experience for you as an editor, how has it been like dealing with the end of Amazon Kindle series, single series, and that sort of process? Has it been interesting, a different experience between putting out a book like An Anxious Age and publishing something like a Kindle single? And how, you know, as an author and editor, how do those feel? Do they feel different in the process, or is it just the form?
No, the process is the same. But really, you know, my days at the Weekly Standard and the magazine in New York disappeared in editing other people's prose. You know, I was putting 40, 50 hours a week into just the sheer editing of other people's prose. And with that burden lifted, I find suddenly, why should this be a surprise, that I have 40 or 50 more hours a week to write on my own. And that part, of course, has been a revelation about how much I can write and how much time I can spend reworking and reshaping my phrasings and the prose. And it's been nice, Kevin. I really liked it. I shouldn't have been surprised by, you know, the lifting of that burden and what it would set me free to do. But I was. It's like, oh, you know, I actually can spend an extra day on this. I don't have to you know, bang it out and let it go as soon as it's done because I have so much else on my plate.
What do you think, any opinions about the world of publishing, the ebook versus the hardcover? I mean, you've been successful in both worlds. Are they going to sort of work together for a while or fight it out? Do you see the technology overcoming the traditional publishing world anytime soon?
You know, I just don't know. I really don't. I read avidly everything that gets published on, you know, the rise of ebooks and the decline of publishers, and yet I still haven't been able to figure out what I think. I think physical books will continue to exist, but maybe only as a kind of specialty market. What happens when publishers really seriously move into ebooks? I don't know. You know, 60% of the world is unconnected to the internet. So what's going to happen with them and books? I don't know. It's an interesting question. I wouldn't be an author, as you well know, unless I was perfectly willing to whine about my publishers. It's the disease that authors have. But I think I'll reserve that for another occasion.
I suppose if you had a really clear picture of where the publishing world was going to be in the next 5 to 10 years, you'd probably be putting a business plan together to take advantage of that.
Exactly.
Insight.
If you get one, Kevin, let me know.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of authors, and I haven't come across a lot of people who have figured it out. So I think it is a pretty complex mystery. Well, thank you so much for talking with us. Again, we've been talking with Joseph Bottom, and author of An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and Spirit of America. Thank you so much for talking with us today, and we'll look forward to the next book, which hopefully will shed some more insight on this fascinating topic.
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin.